I'm Cameron Harold, the founder of the Second in Command podcast. Really quick, before we jump into today's episode, you need to know about two important ways that we can help you and your company grow. Number one, check out the COO Alliance. It's for COOs, presidents, VP ops, or whoever is your company's second in command to the CEO. The COO Alliance is the world's leading community for the second in command, and it gives COOs the tools and connections to grow themselves and the company. Head over to COOalliance.com to learn more about our members and the results, the program, and our 10x guarantee. If you qualify for membership, you can set up a complimentary call with our team to discuss if it's right for you. I'll tell you about number two in a bit, but first, let's start this week's episode.
The biggest struggle early on was, for me, was finding the balance between me and my partner, Pete, who is the CEO. Finding that balance of being able to rely on each other for what we were best at. And I think that that was a struggle for me, for sure. Having to overcome that, having to understand he is better than me at certain things. And that is, for someone who's hyper competitive, that is not the easiest thing to do.
Welcome to the Second in Command podcast, produced by the COO Alliance and brought to you by its founder, Cameron Harold. In the Second in Command podcast, we talk to top COOs who share the insights, strategies, and tactics that made them the chief behind the chief. And now, here's your host, Cameron Harold.
Our guest today is Jocko Fuels co-founder and chief product officer, Brian Littlefield. Jocko Fuels gains worldwide recognition for shaking up the energy drink industry and is rapidly becoming a leader in nutritional supplements, functional foods, and beverages. Paving the way into product development is Brian, and who's co-founder and the mad scientist, who's known for pushing the limits of what's possible with clean ingredients and a balanced, holistic approach. Littlefield's devotion to health and wellness is rooted in his firsthand experience with his brother's battle with childhood cancer and his father's passion for a healthy diet and natural products. Even as he pursued a formal education and career in business, Littlefield continued to study nutrition and holistic medicine as he believes they're the difference between simply living a thriving life. Years later, Littlefield found himself running a Brazilian jiu-jitsu academy and opening up a supplement store. He featured options that he felt best aligned with his beliefs in nutrition, shared knowledge with professional athletes and fighters with whom he trained. Eventually, he joined forces with now partner Pete Roberts, the founder of Origin, and they launched a nutritional division where he would become the chief operating officer and eventually chief product officer. You're going to love this episode. You can also watch it on our YouTube channel. We'll see you on the inside. So, Brian, welcome to the Second in Command podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Cameron.
I'm looking forward to this. Now, you just actually raised a drink as we were talking. Is that one of your drinks?
It
It's got
is.
to be. Okay, good. Jocko,
Sure.
awesome. You tell us, normally I leave this a little bit later, but I think it actually makes sense to kind of dive in right at the very beginning. You're actually a co-founder and COO, or co-founder and kind of the chief product officer. What was it that led you and your partner to start this company in a category that was already pretty crowded?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So it takes us way back to the beginning of how it started before it was actually Jocko Fuel. And that was actually an extension of the company now known as Origin. But many, many years ago, it was known as Origin BJJ. So it was this niche manufacturing company in the woods of Maine that was making jujitsu gis or kimonos 100% American made, and which was a crazy story in and of itself. But the founder, Pete Roberts, and I got linked up through Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and I had the nutraceutical background. And so I came on and actually joined on the Origin side of things, helped build out a retail program and a number of other initiatives. He actually wanted to move me back to Maine, and that's when I became the first COO of the company Origin, which later grew and spawned Origin Labs, which was the nutritional division that we focused really heavily on that combat sports community. And then that evolved into Jocko Fuel when Jocko came on as a partner in 2017.
And is the combat sports component still exist, or have you guys separated that into a whole separate business at this point?
It's still a major core of the business, actually on both sides. So the companies actually ended up splitting about 2 or 3 years ago, and they just both you know, needed their own attention, their own teams, and they were headed in two separate directions. So Origin still focuses on manufacturing product. It does a lot more than manufacture kimonos now. It has all kinds of lifestyle and workwear gear. And, you know, Jocko Fuel has grown into a segment where we're in ready to eat, ready to drink, supplements, and a number of other things. But the company is really separated a couple of years ago.
Okay. Walk me through a little bit. I've never played in the consumer packaged goods space, and I've never played in the beverage space. Where do you sell? Are you direct to consumer? Are you in retail? Do you wholesale? Are you selling on Amazon? Walk us through kind of some of your different delivery channels and how you came about those.
Yeah, so we're a little bit everywhere right now. That hasn't always been the case. We started off D2C, and we did that intentionally. You know, we really wanted to build our direct consumer website business very strong, emphasis on subscription, obviously an emphasis on product to do so. And so that we knew would carry us in the long term as we grew, because we knew we were going to get significant margin dilution as we went out into retail. And same thing on Amazon. Amazon isn't much better, if anything, worse than going and selling into retail. So we knew we needed to build that core business through the website and really embrace those early adopters. And so that's what we did. The next phase was to roll onto Amazon, which was a great growth strategy. And then we kind of jumped in head first. I say dipped our toes, like we jumped in head first into retail with Vitamin Shoppe nationwide. So that was our test. So we went nationwide into Vitamin Shoppe, and we couldn't have done it at a better time. We launched in February of 2020.
Oh my gosh.
I remember I was literally, we launched, we had a small celebration. My wife and I came out there. We flew back to New York and stayed there for like a week. And then we had to head up to Boston for a couple of days, and everything, the news was all hitting that it was happening.
Wow.
And then we got back to Maine, and everything started to shut down. So that was fun. Now our product can be found in convenience. We've really started to dominate regional grocery. So H-E-B, Meijer, Wegmans, we really thrive there in those, I would say, more affluent regional grocery shopping experiences.
Like the micro Whole Foods kind of?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Those markets that can compete against the Walmarts and the Krogers.
I'm curious. Yeah, it's interesting. And is that because your margins can stay a little bit higher? They can sell for a little bit more and you can make a little bit more, or do they not negotiate as fiercely as the bigger chains do?
I think it's a couple things. One of which,
smaller shelf space.
Yeah. Well, we kind of designed that model because we knew that we could target our marketing, whether that be Jocko on his podcast or us through geo-targeting through social. We knew we could target regional areas better than just blanketing the United States. So we did nationwide with Vitamin Shoppe, and that worked well. But when we tested in the regional area, we knew we had a lot of success right away. So what we did is we just took that model and replicated it, and sort of like with Jocko's influence of kind of taking ground militarily, that's what we decided to do. So we picked regions where we started going and attacking those areas and slowly started kind of infiltrating those communities. And it's worked really well.
It's almost like the board game Mission Risk.
Yeah,
exactly. Or Catan or something. Yeah. It's interesting. Starbucks, actually, the way that they got their coffee onto airlines, they didn't go after United Airlines first. They went after Horizon, which was like only in Oregon. And then they went to Alaska, which was kind of the Northwest. And then from there, they got into United. Is that part of your approach now too? Regional? Or are you going to go after the big chains?
Yeah, I mean, eventually the big chains for them.
Or do they just come to you?
That's the key. Is eventually it's undeniable when they see, oh, okay, here's this brand that, you know, maybe they didn't know about or didn't pay attention to or didn't take serious. Here's this brand, and it is taking market share in a category that they're active. We know they're actively trying to grow, but doing it so in their direct competitor regionally, and so. They're like, okay, we need to bring that into store because we want that customer. And so, yeah, that's definitely part of the strategy. And you also have a high level of risk when you go into like a Walmart right out of the gate, because, you know, I've seen so many brands in CPG go in and they can't, you know, generate that velocity, and then they you know, once you get kicked out, like, good luck getting back in.
Yeah, you're not getting back in. And you're also working so hard to make margins that are so thin as well. I remember reading about that probably 20 or 30 years ago. And it was some company that made pickles, and they were selling pickles to Whole Foods, and they were only making like 5 cents a jar selling pickles. It's like, what's the point? Like, you get to a point where it's like, it doesn't even make any sense. So you said something a little bit early on. One of our members of our COO Alliance, we have this large network of second commands, and one of our members, their company is called Wishing You Well. They help brands kind of like you guys sell on Amazon. So they do Dr. Bronner's and they do Clif Bar, and they actually do all the Amazon sales and marketing fulfillment. How have you figured out the Amazon space? And you kind of said, you kind of Audgy shucks over it that, you know, Amazon and retail sometimes aren't even that good. At what point does it start to make sense to be on Amazon? Is it because you have enough volume, you have enough scale, or do you just take the short-term pain because their retail stores are so big?
So we really internally battled with this early on, when to go to Amazon, because we had this growing direct consumer business, and we kind of said, hey, let's grow that website D2C business until we can't, and then go to Amazon. That was kind of like our first thought, but we shifted that when we were convinced to test the waters. And that's what we did. We tested the waters. And what we found was there wasn't a lot of cannibalism between the website and Amazon. Like, they're two different shoppers.
Totally.
Like, there's people that will shop directly on your website and they're committed. And there's people that will not shop anywhere else other than Amazon.
Yep.
And until you're on there, like, you're not in the largest retailer on the planet. I mean, that's what it is.
Yeah.
So if you continue to deny going to Amazon for that reason, that you think you can bring them to the website, I would argue against that. Now, there's other reasons, like if you're already dealing with a low margin product and you just can't really make the math work, like, okay, well, that makes sense. But, you know, in our space, thankfully, you know, ready to drink, ready to eat are a little bit of a different story, but, you know, nutraceuticals are a better or a healthier margin product. So it's a little bit more advantageous there, but, you know, the blended margin works. So what I would say is, if the product fits on Amazon, you should be on Amazon. It's not going to cannibalize your business, most likely. And if it is, you need to rethink your direct consumer strategy.
Yeah. Now, you said something. Now, are you trying to convert the Amazon shoppers to the direct to consumer? Like, do you have, you know, stickers and inserts and stuff in your packaging that when they get it from Amazon, it then brings them to your website to sign up for the ongoings? Or
You have to be really careful with that stuff, right? Because Amazon frowns upon that. So you can't have it on any of the inside of your packaging. And I mean, on the outside of your packaging, rather. And, you know, you can try and sneak some things on the inside. But, you know, what's interesting is, having been, you know, in this space for a long time, I also, there's products that I consume that we don't make, like maybe single letter ingredient vitamins or something. I've followed brands on the platform of Amazon. And what's interesting is the ones that used to do like the little inserts and the stickers and the giveaways, if you go to our website, for whatever reason, have pulled away from that. They seem to be doing that less and less often compared to how much they used to do it. So I don't know if that's because Amazon's cracking down on it that much. We don't really do it. You know, obviously the one thing we do is when we run a campaign, whether it's on Meta or YouTube or Google, SEO, we're not driving them to Amazon. We drive them to our website. Now, what happens is everybody sees a product and they go search on Amazon, and then they find it on Amazon. That's fine. But when we drive traffic, we're going to drive them to our website.
Yeah, makes sense. And you guys are, again, competing in a very, 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 very crowded category with all of your supplements and all your nutraceuticals and all the drinks. Like, how do you decide which products to kill and which products to keep? How do you decide? Like, are there, do you look at inventory turns, or do you look at margin? Do you look at like cost of goods sold? What do you look at to decide which products to keep and which ones to keep? Because some of it is, you can kind of fall in love with the, oh, I love this because whatever, but the data is saying it's dumb. Kind of like what Steve Jobs did in Apple 25 years ago, right? He just killed 80%.
We have been in a position where we haven't had to kill that much. And that's because when we rolled out the product line for Jocko Fuel, it wasn't a line of product, and that's how Jocko wanted it. And that's kind of like the history of the product development, which is what I do now. I'm sure we'll talk about that. But it's one of those things where when we started with Jocko, he wanted to build products that only he took And so he's like, I want to make this because I want to take it. And if people want to buy it, they'll buy it. Obviously, he had a megaphone with the podcast. So we knew people were going to buy it. We didn't know how many people were going to buy it, but we knew people would buy it. So he's like, he genuinely was like, I want to take this product. So let's make this product. So that's what we started with. And it was 1, 2, 3, 4. We didn't like design a line and roll it out. That's just wasn't the strategy. And it's worked out for us. So there's been an adoption process along the way where people, and we have a kind of a varying product assortment. So, you know, there's plenty of people that will take krill oil for heart and brain health benefits, but they could care less about, you know, a healthy energy drink and vice versa. So we appeal to a lot of different people. So we haven't had to skew rat a lot of stuff, but the few things we have, yeah, it's data driven. Like we don't keep anything around that is just based around feeling. I would say the one thing that we still have around that we, you know, obviously don't sell a ton of compared to what we have with the rest of our assortment would be the original product, which was Jocko's white tea. And so that's a legacy product for us. That always exists.
Did you say you wouldn't have to ski rack something?
Skew rat, like skew rat.
Skew. Okay.
Ski rack.
I thought you said ski rack. I think you're placing it on a ski rack. I'm like, dude, you must be a hardcore skier like me to use a
technology
that no one will.
That's great. Using our term ski rat rationalization.
All right. So direct to consumer, and you said something to me just before we went live, and I'm not going to give the exact number because I don't think it's anybody's business, but it's big. You've got a fairly large direct to consumer delivery business, as I understand, where you've got customers, are they just on like a monthly reorder of product, which makes sense, right? Because you need, you know, the supplements or the packets or the whatever.
Yeah, more than 50%. I can't share the exact number, but more than 50% of our customers are on recurring subscription.
That's incredible. Like that's massive revenue for you. So is understanding your cost of acquisition and your lifetime value and the cash conversion cycle, is that part of the magic of building the business?
Yeah. For sure, it definitely is. You know, it's actually a fine line we talk about all the time with our sales and marketing teams and our e-com. We have an incredible team on that side of the business. It's always a balance because we know we believe so strongly in the product and the brand identity and message that we're like, okay, once we get them in, like they stay. It's sticky. So how, you know, we want to blitz scale, but how aggressive do we want to get with this?
How much can you spend to acquire that customer? Not how little, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the, like, where do you find that point of diminishing return? And it feels like every time we reset on like a quarterly or an annual basis, we just continue to push further and further. And we haven't really found that to diminish yet.
Hey there, Cameron here. Are you enjoying the show thus far? We're going to get right back to it in a sec, but just let me ask you a quick question. Are you a COO or a second in command tasked with helping the company hit and exceed its growth goals? Having spent many decades of my life dedicated to this role, I know one of the secrets of growth is to surround yourself with like-minded people, also pushing and striving to go where you want to go. It's why, as a listener to this podcast, I want to officially invite you to the COO Alliance. It's for COOs, presidents, VP ops, or whoever is your company's second in command to the CEO. We're the world's leading community for the second in command, and it gives COOs the tools and connections to grow themselves and the company. When you're a part of this peer group, you'll get access to unprecedented support, guidance, and resources to grow your company's bottom line, improve your ability to streamline processes, connect with other top seconds in command to assist you and bring out your greatest potential, and so much more. Go to www.COOalliance.com to see if you qualify. It's where you can also see other members and the results of the program, as well as our 10x guarantee. If you qualify for membership, you can set up a complimentary call with our team to discuss if the group can be the right fit for you. Once again, it's www.COOalliance.com. Now back to the show. It's interesting. Yeah. I think the smartest companies out there are the ones that truly understand that when you really understand the lifetime value of a customer, like how much money your customers are going to pay you and how much gross margin you're going to accrue over that period, and then really even in the first year or 18 months, how much gross margin you're going to make, it's all about how much money could you spend to get those customers. But most companies are out there trying to get the cost of acquisition down really low instead of just buying up all the market share. So do you guys have like a marketing analytics whiz on this, or do you just measure it on a weekly, monthly basis and keep your pulse on it?
Yeah, I mean, we have.
And do you do it on a product by product basis or kind of the overall category or overall consumer?
We do it product by product, but, you know, more category by category, I would say. We're more focused on the, like how it lands categorically, because again, for instance, I touched on it a second ago, shipping drinks across the country is expensive. Whereas, you know, it's like, okay, well, let's say we can continue to push, let's say you can keep throwing ad dollars at it and you can continue to push ready to drink and shipping heavy cases across the country with free shipping. You're going to find that diminishing return much sooner than if you're allocating it towards something like a small capsule bottle that you're going to be able to ship that already has a higher margin. But let's say the cost of acquisition for that customer is higher. So our data analytics team is constantly looking at the differences and trying to optimize it while also looking at things like inventory, you know, and cash flow.
Okay. So that was my next question, was around inventory. And I've worked with a number of companies. I won't name them, but five or six companies that sell on Amazon, usually in the $30 to $50 million a year range. And one of the core numbers that I've tried to get them to wrap their head around is inventory and inventory turns. And I use a retail number called the 240 number. Is there any way, how do you guys know how much product to have sitting inventory at Amazon and maybe with your own, you know, warehousing? How do you know how to optimize? What numbers do you look at to optimize that inventory so that you don't run out of inventory and so you don't have too much inventory sitting and expiring and so you don't have too much inventory sitting there that you could be utilizing that cash in a better way? Like, how do you manage that inventory? What do you look at?
Yeah, I mean, I would say we were very fortunate in the sense that early on in my role, we had impeccable timing when it came to kind of understanding. I think some of it had to do with literally living in the data. I was early on. Now that we have this incredible team, we obviously have a lot more data. That said, as a brand who's growing the way we're growing and the way we kind of embrace lean principles anyway, I would say it feels good to know that we've actually never had expiring product. So we've never actually expired product ever. You know, sometimes when you launch a new product and you under forecast and you can run out of product. We actually just had that with we have a protein ready to drink product, and we launched a version of it that's called sweet cream coffee. And we actually oscillated internally whether it should be like caffeinated or non-caffeinated. And ultimately we went with caffeinated. So it's this delicious sweet cream. Jocko calls it like a tiramisu taste. It doesn't taste protein. Doesn't taste like protein at all. There's no grittiness or anything. We knew it was going to be successful. We just didn't know how successful. So we ran out of product. Like, we launched, we didn't get a reorder in. And then, so you could say lost revenue or whatever, but at the end of the day, it's probably better to run out of product than to sit on product and have it be thrown away. So, we're not perfect, I guess is what I would say, but you know, we're constantly measuring and testing.
Well, there's also an additional side to this, which is, you can end up with so much product sitting in inventory that cash could be better utilized with marketing or hiring. You know, I think of it like when I go into a retail store and you go into some retail store and they have like one small, one medium, one large, two extra large. Like, okay, they have, and then you go to another store and they have like no small, eight mediums, one large, 12 extra large. Like, who the fuck is buying for you? Like, it doesn't make any sense why your shit is like all over like this. And you realize like they can't be making the money that somebody who is perfectly optimized. And then you've got the Walmarts of the world where they sell the coffee mug and the other coffee mug is getting put on the truck that minute later. Like, they literally are optimized so perfectly. So the number that I always talk about is a 240 number that I learned from a South African in retail. And he takes the gross margin percentage multiplied by the inventory turns has to equal 240. So if you've got like a 60% gross margin, you have to turn your inventory four times. If you've got 80% margin, you got to turn your inventory three times. If you've got like Walmart, 10% gross margin, you got to turn your product 24 times. Do you guys measure anything like that? Do you use software for this, or do you just?
I would say now, like these days, I'm disconnected from the process.
Okay.
In that aspect, we have, you know, senior procurement managers,
right,
and a head of planning. His name's Mark. He came to us from Under Armour. He's a machine. Our team, I'm sure that, I don't know what they're using, but it works.
But they're doing something. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Can you walk us through some of your growth? I mean, you guys started the company off 8 years ago, or you've been with the company for about 8 years. What's your growth been like as a leader, as the second in command? How have you had to grow? And then I guess part two of that, or maybe even part one of that, how did you and Jocko decide how to divide and conquer? Like, who was going to get to do which parts of the business?
Yeah, it's interesting. So, like I said, I was, you know, COO for 1 year before we split the companies essentially and started focusing of Origin. And so COO for Origin, Pete and myself had started the nutritional division and founded it sort of as like a sister company, less so like a child. And then when Jocko came on, it was sort of like the trifecta. Like, Pete is very much we're both very entrepreneurial, but he's very much like big, dreamy, super ambitious, doesn't take no for an answer, and an ultra creative. Like, that's his thing, is like he can literally get into any of the design programs and actually design stuff himself. So he's able to push those teams very hard. Jocko is, for what people know, he is like, he's a legit leader, not just in the sense of like I've written books, but like did it in the military, has done it in his private companies. He is a leader and he is great, but he also lives into that decentralized approach. So he's in and out as he needs to be. Mm. And so where that left me, which was perfect for me in an early stage company, was being in that operational role, because I like doing a lot of different things and having many hats. And when you start off as an organization, I was like, okay, I can do all of my product development stuff, which is what I wanted to do passionately, but I can also build it from scratch. So we literally went from, we were integrated as a business where we had sewing machines and pallets of like protein powder in between the sewing machines. So the stitchers were like, get this shit off of our floor. Like, what is going on? And so we went and got our first warehouse. I set up that lean process with flow racks, added shippers, brought in customer service, like built it and got the flywheel turning. And that evolved and grew and grew. We had to go into a second facility. And, you know, along the way, we brought in our first executive hire, which was our CFO. And then, so that's like, okay, I've relinquished the financial piece of the business. Okay, boom. Now we brought on our first sales executive, our chief revenue officer. Now I'm no longer getting on doing sales calls with retailers like Vitamin Shoppe when we landed Vitamin Shoppe. So you're able to kind of start, you know, parsing that out and hand off those responsibilities, which is tricky. Right. I mean, it's like one of those things, especially for someone like myself, who I like doing a lot of different things. I like being involved in a lot of different processes.
Sure.
So handing that off was tricky, but learning to do it was great for growth. And then, you know, eventually I wanted to focus exclusively on product when we got big enough. And that's, you know, when we brought in a COO to run the organizational vertical of like the logistics and HR and stuff like that, the stuff that I'm not as excited about, but sure, still love and embrace. But that's where I've landed today. And that's, you know, obviously being able to head up all of, you know, product development, product marketing, all those things is exciting.
How about your growth as a leader? What have you had to do to grow as a leader? Because the organization has drastically changed. I would guess that your style, your skills, you know, what you focus on clearly over day to day has changed too. How have you had to grow as a leader?
Oh man, patience and humility. Like when you're early on and you can do a lot of different things and you don't take no for an answer, you think you know it all. And then as you evolve, you realize how little you know. Like when you start bringing in like people that are experts in their field and you start embracing that, you start saying like, okay, like I know a little about that or a little about a lot of different things. But like when we brought in like our CFO, this is a perfect example, like his level, his breadth and depth and understanding of the financials was just like, wow, okay, this is a different level. And then so you're able to, well, you should be able to check yourself and find that humility and be able to grow. And I looked at that as an opportunity. I could have looked at it and said, you know, maybe got defensive or something, but I look at it and say, okay, look how much I can learn from this person. And that's what I've been able to do.
And has there been anything that you had to kind of get humble about as a leader to grow? I mean, there's the book Leadership and Self-Deception. I remember years ago that I used to struggle with some stuff. And when all of a sudden I realized that everybody had stuff to work on, it was easy for me to accept some of my own weaknesses. Were there any areas that were harder for you to grow that you, when you accepted, you were able to kind of go through that glass ceiling or that brick wall?
The biggest struggle early on was for me, was finding the balance between me and my partner, Pete, who is the CEO, like finding that balance of like being able to rely on each other or what we were best at. And I think that was a struggle for me, for sure. Like having to overcome that, having to understand like he is better than me at certain things. And that is, for someone who's hyper-competitive, that is not the easiest thing to do. So absolutely, like understanding where your weaknesses are, like you said, and embracing those and relying on it. Like if you're the greatest person on your team probably sucks. And that's the one thing that I've learned is like, because I'm really good at the one thing, maybe one thing, and I'm okay at other things and they can get done.
Sure.
Nobody can do anything alone that's really going to be, you know, written about, you know, 100 years from now. So embracing where you have your weaknesses is probably the fastest way for success, in my opinion.
It's interesting because that is actually one area that most leaders have to grow through, which is if I start delegating all this stuff, what's my job? And I'm now hiring all these really smart experts that are clearly really smart at stuff that I used to manage. And there's almost like this imposter syndrome that we go through, or like, what is my new job? And so how do you get through that mentally and emotionally? Is it just because you've hired all these great people and now you get to lead them, or the company is scaling, or do you just find new areas of unique ability to work in? How do you work through that?
I mean, it's for me, I would say it's two things. One, I have a great team of mentors as well to talk about things and discuss things and talk about, you know, ones that are detached from the organizations or maybe running their own great organizations. So having a great circle of people to talk about challenges is amazing. And then the other one is just time. It's just time. It's like, okay, maybe you're internally reluctant, but you're going to be a team player, but that thing is still stuck with you. But then once that person actually hits the ground running and shows you like, wow, yeah, I should have relinquished this thing maybe a little bit sooner, you just start building up these kind of emotional calluses. Like it is okay to let go. And so I started to become more and more accepting in passing things off because, you know, whether it's because we got really lucky and found really good hires, or we were just like really diligent about who we brought on, we haven't had a lot of turnover. And a lot of people have grown within their respective roles. So when you see that over and over again, it just becomes more like acceptable. It's just easier to say, okay, yeah, no, we need someone for that. And so now my mindset has shifted. Whereas before I was like defensive. Now I'm like, okay, what can I pass off?
Right.
What can I find? So what is the area at which I can find someone to do better that will add a top line benefit to the organization?
So I've always believed that a leader's core job is to grow people, right? To grow their skills, grow their confidence, grow their network. How do you, as a leader, grow the people and the team that are working around you and for you?
For me, I like to do, everybody has their own way and their own style. But for me, it's like, it's all about trust. So I personally like when my partners and people around me trust me to do what I need to do. And I think that people are motivated by trust. And so whether that's trusting them to do something new, trusting them to execute a plan, trusting them to take on bringing on a new hire and maybe not micromanaging that process. Like, people want to be trusted, and for the most part, they want to be left alone. And so when you're bringing in someone, maybe not who's like, you know, on job training, when you're bringing in someone who's an expert in their field, or close to, it's important to trust them. You know, you need to trust but verify, but you need to trust. The key word there is trust. I find that when you trust people and they feel like they can trust you, then the organizational culture is, it's going to thrive.
Now, I would guess that being an organization that's based in Maine, that you've always had some remote people or people that are living and working in other cities. I can't see that you're hiring everybody in the state of Maine, are you? Or
So COVID actually helped us out a lot, because I would say I was like barely strong about it, but my partner Pete was very strong about it. And it was one of those things where if you were not living in Maine, we would move you there. And so in the first few years, it really capped our talent pool. And, you know, there were some people that it was great. They're like, listen, I don't like being around a lot of people. I like the outdoors. I want to hunt, fish, hike, ski, snowboard, do all that stuff, boat, fish, you know, like if you want to do that and you don't mind being not near a lot of like stores and things that are open late and entertainment, Maine's a great place for you. But a lot of people, they didn't fit into that box. So it was a little bit hard finding people early on. When the remote work thing shifted, it made it a lot easier to find talent. So yes, I would say in the first few years, almost everybody was in Maine, and then it quickly moved outward and we embraced the remote work, and it has worked out really.
How have you learned to adapt as a leader when you are leading people and managing people that are remote? What kind of skills, what tools have you incorporated or brought into your business that is helping with that? And the second part of that is, how do you build the connections with people when you see them for 30 minutes a week instead of every day, you know, walking down the hall, the saying hi is like, they're gone for like the next 7 days again.
Yeah. Well, it's not easy. It's definitely more challenging than doing it face to face. That's for sure. A couple things we do, we try and get the teams together, period. Like, even though we're remote, like we'll do, an annual summit. We do quarterly meetings, in the city, one of our offices, and we'll bring in all of our sales and product and marketing teams quarterly so they can sit together and we go through, you know, we're doing actual work, but at the same time, it's a team building exercise. You're getting face to face, we're ordering out, we're getting cats delivered, you know, we're having, you know, an experience together. And so I think that that's important. I think companies need to invest into that time. If everybody's out spread out across the country or the world, like, you need to invest in bringing them together periodically. So I think that's a big one. Obviously we do all of our meetings, you know, with video. So it's important for that rather than just phone calls. But we also encourage people to just, even though you're not seeing someone, like, we encourage people to just pick up the phone and call someone else's direct line. Like, hey, don't send a friggin' email. Just pick up the phone, cut through all the bullshit and the time, reduce the information that needs to be read through email, just call them. And so that's really important. We think that, you know, goes a long way.
It totally goes a long way. It's interesting that you talk about like bringing people together. Somebody, I don't remember where it was, said that the onsite is the new offsite, right? That we used to take people offsite to go build connections and team. Now we're bringing them all onsite to build connections and team. It's awesome. All right. I want to go back to the 21, 22 year old Brian Littlefield, and I want you to give yourself some advice. What advice would you give the younger you that you know to be true today, but you wish you'd known when you were just starting out in your career?
A lot, but let me pick one. Oh boy. I would say embrace networking, probably build authentic relationships. Don't embrace the things that are like fleeting and coming and going. Like, find authentic relationships, go out of your way to build. This is kind of segues, but, you know, I get a lot of like, I've done a lot of like young entrepreneur type podcasts, and they're like, what can you do to like get in the circle? And it kind of ties into the networking thing. And it's like, network, but add value. So I think I would say like, network, but add for some friggin' value. Don't ask to be part of the group. Like, if you can even scratch your way near a successful group of people, find a way to add value to them, like ask them what you can do for them.
Yeah.
Not always like, hey, can you give me this resource on marketing or accounting, or hey, what do you think about this idea? It's like, you know, actually ask what you can do for them. So that's what I would say.
I love that. It's interesting. It's actually one of the mottos of the COO Alliance. This, you know, this network of second commands from all over the world is share, then learn. Because if we always come up trying to like learn and extract from everybody else, we forget that they need to learn from us. But there's always a little bit of this imposter syndrome that we think that, oh, well, I don't really know if what I have is valuable. Yeah, but it might be your idea plus two other people's ideas. And they take those three ideas and merge into exactly what they're looking for. So I love that you get that. All right, Brian Littleton, thanks so much for sharing with us on the Second Command podcast. Super appreciative.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to Second in Command, brought to you by COO Alliance founder Cameron Harold. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to like, share, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and our other podcast streaming platforms. For more best practices from industry-leading COOs, visit COOalliance.com.